Good morning. It is the 24th of January. It is a Friday. I hope you're having an awesome day. The weekend is ahead of you. But I thought we would do something pretty important this morning. We don't often do this, especially not on a Friday, but there's so much going on that, you know, I'm always amazed at how scurrilous this government are, that they try to squeeze things past us when we least expect it. And, you know, everybody wants to get their greedy little hands on all the stuff that you've worked so hard to do. And this government probably one of the worst governments in the world when it comes to this stuff. In other words, taking things that are not theirs. And they're pretty much declaring war on the public of South Africa with some of these bills that they try to pass quietly while we're distracted by things like Donald Trump or whatever else we could be distracted by. And there is an organization in this country that's doing a tremendous amount of good. And I know these two guys so well, and it's an entire group of people who are hard at work behind the scenes, lawyers. It's obviously a very costly exercise. We'll talk to them about that too. But Russell Lamberti and Piet LaRoux are from Sakalicha. Now, it sounds like an organization that many people wouldn't have probably heard of, but they are the power behind what makes so much happen in terms of challenges to this government. So I want to introduce them to you. They're in the studio this morning. Russell is an economist. He's an author with extensive experience in macroeconomic and investment strategy consulting. He was appointed as the chief economist in September 2021 to Sakalicha. And Piet LaRoux is the chief executive officer of the organization. He's held that position since September of 2017. Under his leadership, Sakalicha have actively opposed all kinds of really, really terrible policies that this government have tried to put into play and force upon us, like all kinds of Black economic empowerment, which we know has been absolutely useless and done nothing that it set out to do. All it's done is make Cyril and his friends rich. They've engaged in legal challenges to prevent the expansion of those requirements and so many other things. So, gentlemen, thank you so much for coming in this morning. I'm really, really sorry that I'm not there in person, but I'm delighted that you could be on the show, and I'm thrilled to bring a bit of a spotlight onto what you're doing, because I think most people in this country are blissfully unaware of just how this government is trying to undermine all of our rights when it comes to our property, when it comes to our freedom, and when it comes to our money.
Hi, Gareth, it's great to be with you on the show, and thanks for that wonderful introduction. We enjoy what we do, and we try and be a simple enough organization to understand. We provide better business environments so that communities can flourish. And normally, you know, the old thing is people say, well, what's the role of the state? And then they say, well, it's to make, provide a good business environment for business. That's the economic role of the state. Well, we say, nope, actually, that's the role of business people themselves. And yeah, for a while, we've outsourced that to the state. We've let the state become very powerful. And in modern times, and the modern state all over the world today says, it basically thinks it can and should do everything and anything. And we're just there to say, if the state does something wrong, we'll be there to oppose it. The state's not all powerful. And also, it's not right to expect everything from the state. Business people themselves can provide a better business environment. And we can get into some of how we do that through litigation, but also through alternative structures and alternative ways to make the world and the economy better for the communities that should benefit from them.
All right, so Piet, I just want to point out that Simpiwe looks very good in my chair this morning, and she looks like she's taking. I like it, Sims, but often Simpiwe and I will talk about how, you know, the best thing, if I want to deal with her or with anyone else, if I want to sell Simpiwe something, she wants to buy something from me, there's no need for government to be involved in that transaction. I'll say, Simpiwe, this pen I will give to you for 20 cents, and she'll look in her wallet and she'll say, I don't think it's worth 20 cents, but I've got 15 cents and I can decide whether or not that's a deal or not. There's no need for government to be involved in that, right, Sim?
Yes. Yes.
So how do they wheedle their way into everything that we do? And how do they try to pass these laws surreptitiously and under the carpet? Russell, you know all about this. They're always trying to pass new laws to acquire things that are not theirs. And by theirs, I mean not for the people of South Africa. I'm not saying for the broad mass of people in this country who are, some of them, in desperate need and on social welfare in a system which is unsustainable. I'm talking about people in government themselves. We see that there are a couple of ministers who are under the spotlight at the moment for trying to steal and for doing tenders and deals behind the scenes that everybody only finds out about much, much later. These kinds of laws will enable them to do so much more of that. Is that right, Russell?
Hey, Gareth. Yeah, great to be here. These are great questions. These are tough questions. They're philosophically interesting and difficult questions. Why do certain people try to insert themselves into free and private transactions? One reason is because they can. They've developed the position and the mechanisms to be able to extract resources. It's a way of getting by without adding real value. It's a way of making a living without it doing the hard work of learning a real skill. In a sense, that developing their own kind of skill for extracting. And we have a state sector and a government that, not unlike many other parts of the world, has used the mechanisms of state to intervene in otherwise free and private transactions to extract. And we've got to, there's kind of two ways we can look at this, Gareth. We can sit and complain about it all day long. And there's some merit in complaining, sure, because from complaining can spark action. But if we don't ever take action, we're just going to be complaining that a group of people are extracting from private and value adding transactions. And so we got to say at some point, listen, this is the way of the world. There are people who who get into positions and are able to use certain mechanisms of power and of the state to extract. And really what this comes down to is, can we resist and can we check that kind of power and put it in a kind of box where it is constrained to only doing very, very minimal functions? For example, when you think of civil government, you think of really administrative functions, some sort of levels of bureaucracy, potentially basic kind of governance functions, overseeing certain areas of life and of order. But by no means have any of us consented and given consent to this idea that a state can sit over every transaction, over every domain of society, and call the shots and extract resources from it. And but if we are stuck at just the complaining stage, we're losing. So we have to move beyond that. And a big part of Saak Alicha's reason for being is to move beyond that into a domain of action where we are finding out ways, using mechanisms and tools available to us, Gareth, to check state power and to actually push back against this.
So, Russell, I love that explanation you've just given, and I want to go into the detail of what Saak Alicha does in a moment, because you guys have got some pretty impressive wins in the bank already. And these are wins that they're technically wins for the whole of South Africa, not just for you guys. And we'll find out who you represent, kind of how the business works or how the organization works, and what your priorities are in just a minute. I'll ask Pete to start with that in a second or two. But I do want to quickly go to the story which is in the news at the moment, and something which we should be very concerned about. I see lots of noise around this, and I know you guys probably know more of the detail than most of us would. What exactly is this law that the president is supposed to have assented to yesterday, this Expropriation Act, and what is its impact on the rights of ordinary people like me and Simpiwe and all the people in the comment section and South Africans at large?
Gareth, it's a serious impact, but in the short run, it's not that intensive, although in the long run, it's really harmful. This bill that's now signed, so it now becomes the Expropriation Act, it's called the Expropriation Act for the reason that it enables government to expropriate. Now, all governments around the world expropriate from time to time, and the standard way of doing that is you have to pay the person you expropriate the money that the asset was worth. So the standard argument here is, well, we need to build a road and we need to take that land from you, but we'll pay you for the land. Even if you don't want to sell us, we'll still pay you a fair price. That's standard expropriation law all over the world. But what this Expropriation Act now does in South Africa, it says, well, or we can take that land, we're the state, and we're maybe not going to pay you anything at all. And so it's just expropriation without compensation is what this enables. It doesn't say it'll always be without compensation, but the principle that this can now be done without compensation, that somehow the government can now figure out not what's the fair price, but what does it want to give you, is a big problem with just saying no. And you'll see many entities in civil society, also other political parties, making a big story about this because it is.
Pete, hasn't there been a bit of a sleight of hand with the way they've put this together, where they are saying that zero compensation, if you call it nil compensation, it is a form of compensation that just happens to be zero.
Yeah, it's a legal fraud. They're really committing a legal fraud. So you may recall, Gareth, and your listeners will know, there was like 5, 7, 8 years ago, there was a big brouhaha about changing the constitution so that there can be expropriation without compensation. And then that didn't go through. But now there's sort of a legal sneak that's happening here. The government's trying to change the act so that there can be expropriation without compensation, without changing the constitution. So that already tells you that this thing is on shaky legal ground. And the sneak here is to say that, well, we are going to pay you expropriation, the compensation, the value of that compensation is going to be zero. So we just say that's a legal fraud. I mean, if it's zero, it means it hasn't been compensated.
All right. So let's do a comprehensive top to bottom look at Saak Kalicha here, because for many people, they may have heard about you guys somewhere. They may have heard the wrong things about you guys. I, for example, saw your offices for the first time not so long ago, and you told me about some of the stuff that you do. And I think it's important for the rest of the country to hear about what work you've been doing, and tell us also about some of those wins that you've had in the past couple of years.
Thanks, Gareth. We're based in Pretoria, and we also have offices in Stellenbosch. Russell mostly operates from there. We're called Saak Kalicha. It simply means business league. And we think, what we do is we're a vehicle for creating better business environments for the common good and the public interest. That vehicle, building that vehicle, is the first thing we do. We're a non-profit, so we are funded by business people, by ordinary people, even just employees. They don't necessarily have businesses, but generally we're funded by businesses who want to invest in a better business environment. And we're building this capability to oppose the state where it's necessary, to reform it where it's possible, and to provide some alternatives. Now, we're mostly known for our litigation. We've won in the Constitutional Court in South Africa 5 times on matters of property rights, on matters of Eskom cutting off the power to towns, on matters of BEE. So we've actually, about 2 years ago, we won the first major case against BEE in procurement, and we re-enabled it for municipalities and entities of state to procure on a more value for money scale. And then currently we have something like 6 concurrent cases in litigation and more than that in development. So that's what we're best known for, is this litigation, where we've proven this capability of reforming the state where it's possible, pushing back where it's harmfully intervening. Litigation doesn't solve everything, so we can get on to the other stuff we're also doing, but that's what we're best known for. And I think we're now the best litigant on economic matters in the public interest in the country. I don't think we've ever seen something like this, and we think we're just beginning.
That is amazing. And I see Lee in the comments. To your point, Pete, Lee says, why isn't anyone stopping them? Where's the DA? Aren't they trying to stop it? What about the Government of National Unity? Weren't they meant to stop things like the Expropriation Act? I mean, thank God for organizations like yours, because otherwise there would be no one looking after the interests of ordinary South Africans. And by the way, for people who think that because it's an Afrikaans name, Saak Kalicha, and because you go at things like BEE, that doesn't mean that you have a very narrow interest, or that you're only representing a small group of people in this country, you know, who are trying to protect, I don't know, their capitalist ill-gotten gains, as the socialists might try to disguise it. Just explain how you can take membership from anywhere, funding from anywhere. You've helped many people who probably don't even know who you guys are.
Yeah, Gareth, you know, we often like to say that something, for example, like certain BEE policies might at the outset be direct attacks on predominantly white-owned business. There's actually an asterisk that one has to put to that. There's some exceptions to that. That might be the initial case, but really the resultant kind of negative multiplier effects of policies like this are really colorblind. because the economy is an integrated network of businesses doing transactions and adding value to one another across racial lines. So when you kind of indiscriminately or discriminately hurt various nodes of that network, you hurt the whole network. And so this is really harming communities across the country. Probably the best way to see this is in the way that state procurement has been operating for the last 20 years or so. What BEE has done in state procurement has throttled the number of suppliers that can supply to the state, and thereby just, this is basic economics, when you throttle supply, you raise costs substantially and you lower quality. South Africans out there, black, white, colored, Indian, of all groups, all communities, have experienced a rising cost of living, rising cost of services, and a declining quality of services. And actually, this ends up hurting the most vulnerable the most, the people who most rely on those services. A lot of us can use our paychecks to buy private security, shield ourselves, put solar panels on our roofs and so on. But a lot of people out there are indiscriminately kind of impacted by this, Gareth. So we see this as absolutely in the public interest.
Let's be honest here too, that if BEE was broad-based black economic empowerment and it was actually helping black businesses to thrive, we would see so many more of those coming to the fore, taking part in the economy, growing substantially. Instead, we just see a small coterie of people who are politically connected, making all of the money and doing none of the services. I mean, a lot of these people are purely coming in, extracting resources and or rent and leaving no value behind. So people have got to start being honest about BEE. It's certainly not a policy that has benefited anyone except a bunch of ANC cadres who find themselves no longer in politics or still connected to it in some way. That's about right.
You know, Gareth, these sorts of central planning directives have always and will always continue to have these very kind of perverse effects. So in some people's minds, they might be thinking, you know, BEE harms this kind of, white-owned business. And there is certainly that. And some of what we call the third wave of BEE, which is this kind of latest wave of BEE that we're seeing coming out of government, is really attacking your ability to participate in the economy. And we can get into some of that. We'll get into some of the details on that. But there's some really perverse effects of this. You know, let's say you're a black entrepreneur, you start and build a great business, and you then want to realize some of the value of that business, and you want to exit. You sell half your business, or you might even sell two-thirds of your business, and the buyer of that business happens to be a white person. You've suddenly disadvantaged your business. You suddenly are now having built this great business, having exited, still owning a third of the business, have now put that business potentially into a situation where it actually can't operate as successfully, where even it might be subject to losing a license to operate down the line. So in really quite real ways, one of the consequences of this policy is that it diminishes the incentive for doing business across racial lines. It can actually force a situation where companies want to stay kind of monoracial as opposed to kind of integrative. That's just one of many strange and kind of perverse effects of this sort of central planning. It's very, very counterproductive and something that we're very proud to oppose because, we think it's incredibly harmful, and that which is harmful must be stood up against.
So I like the way that you explain that, because people don't understand this stuff until they see some misleading headline on News 24 and they think that they understand the whole story. Pete, let's just talk a little bit more about Sakalicha. How do you guys get your money in? Because going to court against government is a very expensive business. I mean, they will spend our money, by ours, I mean taxpayers, willy-nilly to defend themselves, even if they've come up with some really ridiculous ideas that are indefensible. But they'll put it through the courts. They'll pay a bunch of lawyers to keep it stuck or to move it along very, very slowly. And mostly they just bankrupt anybody who goes up against them. So how have you managed to A, beat them, but B, more importantly, pay to beat them? Because this is expensive.
Yeah, we've over the years built a wonderful legal team that litigate unemotionally. I think this is one thing where we try and litigate showing, demonstrating harm, and we are careful in what we ask of the court. You can go about this strategically because you must not expect too much of the court. Courts are not able to order the impossible. So courts cannot order ESCOM to produce power if it's being load shed. Courts can also find it very difficult to order things that are too much against the dominant political view. So we don't think that courts can, by the stroke of one judgment, say that there will not be BEE anymore in this country. You have to tackle this piece by piece and unemotionally and based on public interest. And that's what we've done. And we've been very successful with this. Like 95% of everything we've asked for, we've gotten through the courts. We're also able to litigate efficiently. So we would litigate. I'd be surprised if we litigate less than a 10% of what it costs the government to oppose us. Now that still has to be funded. But we've fortunately built a wonderful base of small and large funders, and they fund us every month and every year with enough of what we had necessary to get to where we are. We're looking to expand that because just much more needs to be done given the intensifying harms coming from the union buildings there in Pretoria. But we built this on a non-profit basis, and so we've got all sorts of transparency there. Every cent that comes into Saaklicha is well spent, and the return on investment from a public interest perspective is I don't think there's anything comparable in the commercial sphere.
Gareth, we've built up about 10,000 funders, 10,000 supporters over the last decade and a bit, who support us with anything from 50 to 100 rand a month. Small but committed donations like that, all the way up to large kind of corporate funders. So we basically have a crowd fund that constitutes about half our funding, and a kind of larger corporate funding base. But it's wonderful to have that base, and we are open, to anyone who wants to get behind this kind of mission. It's really in the public interest. We have a very kind of diversified, large funding base, and so it doesn't over concentrate our funding risk anywhere, and enables us, as Pete says, to really tackle these sorts of things. But we need to grow, because what we're seeing, and unfortunately, we're in some ways seeing this even more rapidly over the last 9 months or so, is the desire of the state, of this government, to push out harmful policies, to continue to attack private businesses, the private sector, to continue to engage in value destruction. This is actually accelerating, Gareth. People need to understand this. There's an acceleration going on. And it's not, Saaklicha is not the only answer. There's lots of organizations doing lots of good things in different spheres of society. But in this area of harmful economic policy, we need to do much more. And so we need to scale that up. This is an expensive exercise, but we're very, very confident that people, and we're very encouraged, people are getting behind our mission because they see that we're having impact.
Well, I like that. And Lee in the comments says, how can we help Saaklicha, Russell and Pete? And lots of other people saying, can we give you Bitcoin, says Bitcoin Boots. So how do people contribute? Because I do think that there are probably people listening to this morning going, finally, we've put our trust in politicians. They're obviously no good. They let us down. Even these guys in this government and National Unity are letting us down. We'd rather give our money to people like you who actually get the result and push back against this this obvious parasitism, which government is so damn good at. So how do we do that, Russell? How do we do that, Pete?
It's very, very easy to give us funds. Funding goes a long way with Saaklicha. Of course, if you like what we do, sharing our story with other people is fantastic. Our website, saaklicha.org.za /en for the English website. Very, very easy to go and give us funding there. You can give us once-off donations. You can sign up for a monthly recurring card donation. And if that at some point becomes unaffordable for you, you can go and cancel it or lower it very easily. So it's just super easy to give us funding.
So not like taxes, Russell, where you don't get a chance to say that you don't want to pay that anymore.
Exactly.
Once the government owe them this much, they just take it at gunpoint.
100%. We're a voluntary organization. We're not going to put a gun to your head to give us funding.
And it's great to have that discipline. Our funding base looks, we have to provide value all the time. It's wonderful. I mean, imagine taxes were voluntary. You'd see so much better performance from the government.
Yeah. Funding Sakalich is fully tax deductible as well. So we're
as it should.
Yeah, as it should be. So so what that means is that, you know, so you can actually claim a tax deduction on what you give to Sakalich. That makes more sense when you're giving, you know, slightly larger amounts. And so it means that we can get 100 Rand of benefit for every, and it's only going to cost you, let's say, 70 Rand or so. So that's a nice benefit for us. And it really goes a long way for us.
Yeah. Russell, I should add, I don't want to let Bitcoin Boot not give us Bitcoin. You're very welcome. We have a policy of hodling. So if you want, send us an email to r.lamberti@sakalicha.org.za or just through the website, and we'll be in touch to give you a unique address each time so that you can send it, and you can check our, we'll even show you how we hodl if you want, and you can check the reserves. So you're welcome to send us something the government can't take.
Excellent. Well, listen, guys, I mean, I love the fact that you exist, that you're doing the work that you're doing. But more especially, I think that businesses in this country, particularly the small and medium-sized businesses, who are not able to get into a cozy relationship with government. We see so many corporates in this country who are actually just craven. They will do whatever their political masters in inverted commas tell them to, you know, big corporations, big companies that employ thousands of people. The smaller businesses and medium-sized businesses really don't have any representation. We supposedly have a minister who deals with this sort of thing. I don't know that the Minister of Small Businesses or whatever they call them has ever done anything for any business I've ever heard of. I don't know if you guys have any dealings with that minister. Do you?
We don't really. Do we?
We try not to be too involved on the ministerial level. Just get your expectations up too high.
Yeah.
So we just try and be firm about what we want and what we want to see, regardless of who the minister is and from which party.
But you know, Gareth, you're talking about the corporates. A big buzzword in the last decade or so has been this idea of state capture. You know, people can talk about that. There's some elements to that, but really I think what they're completely missing is corporate capture, in mm-hmm. this country. Many large corporate boards have a so-called man from Pretoria, sitting on their board or influencing their board. Boards have been captured by state interests, and companies are very constrained in acting more freely and more independently, large corporations. And so you're in many ways spot on that a lot of this resistance is coming from outside of that space. But I would just caution people that this is not just about small businesses resisting, and certainly it is also that. There's a lot of great large businesses in this country, Gareth, that are independent, privately owned, non-listed, non-corporatized companies out there that are really getting behind this mission. It's very exciting. A lot of good companies out there that you've never heard of that are actually starting to stand up and act independently, and it's great news.
Well, those businesses should be doing this, and they should have started doing it a long time ago because their survival depends on it. I see Derek in the comments saying, it's no wonder that people don't want to invest in South Africa. If I were in a first world country and I had money to invest, I don't know if I'd send it here. I mean, he's putting it mildly, but the fact is that these are things that create an environment for ordinary people to be able to do business or prevent people from doing that business. And I think that there's very little that this government has done to stimulate small businesses, medium-sized businesses to create less.
You guys,
part of what you do is something called the red tape revolution. Let's just talk about that for a second, because they do put obstacles in our way. If I just want to start a little spaza shop with Simpiwe, how much red tape do I have to go through there? And we know, even in the informal sector, government are trying to get their dirty fingers on things.
We see business licensing attempts in the informal sector. In the formal sector, you have these mega requirements, filling forms before you can sell that proverbial pen that you spoke about earlier. In lockdown, there were lots of crazy stuff happening in lockdown. You had the short sleeve shirt. Patel, fortunately, he's gone now. But one of the things he tried to push through during lockdown, him and the Minister of Small Business at the time, they wanted to introduce a system of business licensing where you had to obtain the permission from the CIPC and from other entities of state before you could be classified as an acceptable entity to do business under conditions of lockdown. Now, the problem was if we had allowed that to get in place, then today that would still be there and you'd still have to get some other kind of license. So fortunately, we were able through court action just to stop that already. I mean, that's a everybody's forgotten about that, even we sometimes, but that was a big thing that we achieved 4 years ago, preventing a system of general business licensing being introduced in South Africa.
Yeah, it's just to latch onto that quickly, licensing is such a big issue, Gareth. People in modern times, we've sort of become used to there being licensed economic, modes of economic activity. What we're seeing in what we call the third wave of BEE is government trying to attach BEE requirements to licensing, such that if you don't meet those requirements, you lose your license to operate. In other words, you get excluded from participating in the economy on the basis of race.
Tell us about what's happened in real estate. I mean, what they've tried to do with the estate agents.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's probably one of the most advanced forms of this third wave of BEE. Last year, the property regulator actually started withholding licenses from estate agents and various other property businesses for not having met the regulator's stipulated BEE score. We opposed that, and the regulator took legal advice, and that legal advice indicated to them that they would lose in court on that basis, and they actually then withdrew that policy. So thanks to our action, that's a victory. That's a pre-litigation victory. It's a pre-court victory, if you like. But we're not slowing down on that. There's problems with the Property Practitioners Act. There's problems with the extension of licensing beyond estate agents to all kinds of other types of property business that have nothing to do with needing licensing requirements. And let me just say, Gareth, that this is more than a BEE story. It's more than trying to attach a BEE requirement to licensing. They can really attach any kind of arbitrary requirement to the license. They can say your hair needs to be 10 inches long, or you need to fill out these forms, or you need to tick these boxes, or you can only get a license renewal if you pledge not to, let go of staff for the next 3 years. And they can really put any kind of constraint and restriction on your ability to do business. And I just want to underscore for people how important this is. South Africa has so badly underperformed from a growth perspective, from an economic growth perspective, over the last decade and a half. If this country, Gareth, had grown at just the average of our emerging market peers around the world, comparable countries to South Africa, like Indonesia and Mexico and Argentina and, all these sorts of countries around the world. If we'd grown at just the average of those countries' growth rates, our economy today would be double the size than it is today. In other words, everyone on average would have double the income that they are earning now every year. It just shows you what an incredible lost opportunity this hyper-regulated regulatory state has been for this country, and this unattractive investment environment and this slow and zero growth environment that we've been in for so long. And that, of course, has spillover effects to the political arena. People get frustrated, people get angry with one another, and you've seen that tension boiling up. We are way underperforming in this country, and what big, huge part of our mission is to unlock that potential and see that that prosperity rising and going up over the coming years.
Now, the only people who I could think would be opposed to that would be people who have their hands in the trough already and see this as the only way for them to ever make money. There are so many things we can get into. I want to talk about the role of small towns in a bit, because you guys are also very involved in that. And we've seen so many of our small towns just disappear, quite apart from the litigation and the wins that you've had there. Most people, before we get into the small towns, most people in South Africa seem to think that we can vote our way to a better state of existence, that we can use democracy to achieve all of our hopes and dreams and ambitions. But I mean, political parties have been disappointing, and I'm being gentle about this in every which way. I think, and you guys probably are exemplary of this, sometimes the solutions lie outside of the political system. And by that, I don't mean revolution. I mean that you've got to take on government using the tools at your disposal, as Saar Kalisha does. But there are so many ways that we can actually push back against things which are just genuinely bad for us. Am I right about that, Russell?
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Gareth. People can get very blinkered and kind of overly focused on a mechanism called, you know, voting every 5 years. And you vote for the brand that you like and that matches your tastes. And then you sit back for 5 years and hope that the people that you put there produce the kind of results that you hoped and dreamed for. And what we've seen over a long time now, this hopefully isn't controversial, is that this has been an absolutely terrible strategy. On the whole, the disappointment is palpable and it's perennial. And we never seem to really get what we want. And we just think this is Pete, you've got some thoughts on this, additional thoughts on this, but we just think this is a low-powered mechanism for change. It's our theory of change lies outside of this kind of stale party democratic politics. We don't think that to get things done, you have to always convince the most people or the majority of people to do things. And by the way, Gareth, as you know, as a business owner, you don't go and take a consensus of the whole country or a poll of the whole country before you act and before you do things. You sit with yourself, maybe some shareholders, a little board of directors, and you come up with strategies and you go and implement them. And you use that agency to act. And we think that's a far more potent and effective way to get things done. The democratic process is certainly in this country not a mechanism that we see for kind of viable change. Pete, I don't know if you want to add to that.
We sometimes use the concept of vacuums of order, vacuums of power. What you see with state failure is that it leaves a vacuum. So if you go to some of the towns across the country that you've mentioned now, Gareth, they're not in a great state. In fact, the state is absent there. The mechanisms of order that we expect from the state is absent. And in that vacuum, will step other forms of power, as they do all over the world. And those forces of power, those forces will be either forces for good or forces for bad. You'll either have gangs taking over, as in some of these towns, in the parliament in Northwest, it was described as some of these towns run by gangsterism. Or you'll see chambers of commerce, local community organizations banding together, finding the capital amongst themselves that they can, and filling it with alternative service delivery, alternative security provision. So we see the solution to state failure in South Africa it's not a question of just getting the state to work. Maybe we can just replace what the state was supposed to do with something driven by elements of the community, whether from a commercial or a non-commercial side. You don't need to make the state strong again to fix the country. You can just make communities and chambers of commerce strong. And we think that's the road to recovery in the countryside. It won't work everywhere because some towns have probably gone too far and they'll be in a bad shape for a long while. And you see exodus from these towns. But if we don't find a way to stabilize the majority of towns and rural areas in South Africa, there will be an exodus toward regional towns. And from there, because of the extra burden, they won't be able to cope with it. Then that exodus will be to the metros. And then we'll sit with a cascading failure of local governance like we're seeing in Johannesburg now. So it's really important to solve for state failure at a local level, not by trying to prop up the state, but by empowering chambers of commerce, chambers of industry, and local community organizations to provide and step into the vacuum themselves.
Yeah, I'm tired of hearing someone, you know, saying things like, "Oh, if the DA just became our government, then everything would be better," which we know is nonsense. We need people like you guys, and of course, everybody deep down inside. This is what I love about South Africans, old and young, black and white, rich and poor. South Africans make a plan, right? I mean, we proved this during lockdown. And again, this is one of the things I want to thank you guys for during lockdown, that you stood up against those ridiculous. And now we can say with absolute safety and security in our minds, those were completely unnecessary and made up rules for something which was never nearly what they described it to be. I just remember that National Coronavirus Command Council making the most stupid rules up. And thank God you guys were there to oppose them. But everybody in this country, what I love about people here is we make a plan. When we get told we must do something, we must do something else, we either go into direct civil disobedience, as we did with e-tolls, which I again think is great, and I'm very proud of South Africa for doing that. And for all the motorists who just said, we're not going to do this, guys, go to hell. We're just not going to pay you. You already take enough out of our pocket that you are not entitled to, that you did not earn. You're not getting this as well. And people have put up, as you mentioned earlier, Russell, solar panels. I think it was you, Pete, sorry, solar panels. People are sinking boreholes. People are reusing rainwater. People are finding ways to get off the grid, wherever they can. And again, this isn't just rich people. There are poor people doing this too. The people who are putting up one little panel to charge their cell phone so that when the government can't provide electricity to them, and they're expected to pay an outrageous cost for this, that they can manage on their own. But then it goes from the individual or the family in the house to the community. And we've heard about communities like Harry Smith, who managed to sort out their water problems without any help from the government at all. So there are examples of this everywhere. And I'm just glad at the highest levels, you're helping us. But tell us how, in a small town like, I don't know, Bethel or something, how people will manage better with the influence that you guys bring to bear, and how they can organize themselves, because you can't do everything for us.
Yeah, there's a road to get there. I think where this the growth we'll see is where, as unfortunately we'll see the growth only after a sharp deterioration. So in some of the towns where we're involved, towns like Lichtenburg in Northwest, we've been involved there for about 3 years now, and we are driving some of the litigation around this. Not that we think the litigation will get the state to do its job, but we need to do the litigation in order to create the jurisprudence and the platform for negotiation by which the local Chamber of Commerce, local businesses, local business organizations, and the local community organizations can step into that vacuum. Because in a normal functional society, you have common law, you have legislation, and these provide defined areas of responsibility, defined mechanisms for how to interact with each other. And unfortunately, these are all breaking down because some of these laws are empty. I mean, the words are there on paper that the government should provide electricity and maintain the electricity network in a town like Ditsebotla or Lichtenberg in Northwest, but it's not happening. And then it doesn't really help you to say, but just again and again, the law says you should. The law is empty when there's no ability left. And so what we think will happen is that through a combination of Sakeliga strategic litigation efforts, where we develop jurisprudence in one town and in another town together, they will add up over time with our support also to the local businesses to set up mechanisms for negotiation, to set up mechanisms for alternative service delivery, and then not take over the municipality, but take over the services, provide alternative administration. In whose interest? Well, of course, in the interest of the businesses that fund this. That's where the capital lies. But that's the as with all business, good business, it always has a positive network externality. So we'll see these towns improve once we develop, once we support them with suitable jurisprudence, once we embolden them with the confidence and the legitimacy to step into the vacuums, not trying to confront the state, but just stepping into the vacuum where the state has absconded.
Maybe I could just add there quickly as well. You know, Gareth, you spoke about the resilience that people are developing, and that's absolutely true. And we're seeing that in so many ways in this country. We just mustn't get too stuck on this kind of hyper-individualized concept of resilience. So by all means, yes, make yourself individually resilient, put panels on your roofs and sink the borehole and you know, build that kind of resilience. But it's so important that we also consider this concept of scale. We have a situation where we have, for example, in energy, virtually a single point of failure. We have a national monopolistic energy provider, and we've seen what happens when that fails. It's been an absolute disaster. The answer to that is not necessarily a solar panel on each roof. I mean, anyone with solar rigs on their houses know that these are not super high-powered energy sources, and they're very, very expensive. What we need more is something like the concept of decentralized scale, a power station in every town that's independently run, or a few competing power stations in every town that are independently run, so that there's not a single point of failure, but there's that scale of electricity distribution. There's, you know, costs are kept down. Take that concept into water networks, into into crime prevention and private security and so on. What I'm saying here, Gareth, is the mechanisms of order have to be organized. They have to be able to scale, and therefore they have to be situated within properly constituted organizations, institutions, non-profit entities, and so on. And those entities need to be well run. They need to be well governed, well funded, and often they need permanent staff driving those sorts of initiatives. These are very difficult things to pull together if you're doing it part-time at night. So, for example, just to make this a very concrete point, business chambers in these small towns struggle to have a significant impact when it's kind of a part-time job of, you know, three local businessmen. If you put a full-time jockey in place, you get it funded, and you get that person to really start creating that kind of coordination, and that you start getting real results. And I just want to encourage people to think a little bit beyond the individual resilience into what does an institutional kind of scaled resilience look like. And that's, again, what Sakalicha, you know, it's very much what we're trying to do.
Well, I like this comment from Carl. He says, the problem with this strategy, and obviously it's a solution in many ways, but the problem is that you end up paying tax twice. How do we stop paying the tax that gets us nothing? And I don't know if you guys have any thoughts on this. This is more of a philosophical part of the discussion than anything else. But what do you think the answer to that is? Because people are also sick of getting zero bang for their buck. We know, and I mentioned this in the introduction, that we have millions of people in South Africa who are on social welfare, which is an unsustainable system. We know that the tax base is taxed about as much as it can possibly be, even though there are, 1.6 million people who pay just about all the income tax. And it's probably those people who are also paying the corporate tax. So how do you see this unfolding in the next 2 to 3 years?
That's the situation for now, Gareth. It's not sustainable to pay for everything twice. Now, all through history, there have been examples of some kind of ruler of power who extend their taxation, the weight of their taxation beyond what is sustainable, beyond what is tolerable. And there are many examples from the Magna Carta to others where entities outside of that taxing entity muster enough influence and ability to negotiate an alternative. And so that is where the future of a sustainable and flourishing communities and business community economy in South Africa lies. We need to develop to a position where we are strong enough to renegotiate the terms of what is being paid to the state. Now, we're not at that point, but it's happened all through history. For now, our focus is on litigating to solve for where reform is possible, or to push back and against where the state interferes harmfully. And alternatively, we're working in these towns to fill the vacuums of order. And this is going to be an expensive exercise for the next several years, and then we'll see where that takes us. But it, at some point, it has to take us where all flourishing societies before they on their path to recovery went in history, which is to renegotiate the terms of what the state can extract from society.
We should add as well that, Gareth, we're extremely supportive of good, sensible, intelligent, and creative ways to pay as little tax as possible to the government. It's also worth saying that as alternative centers of order develop, capital shifts in different directions, and it's increasingly difficult in many instances for the state to keep track of that and to kind of get its hands on that. And we're actually seeing this. Our government is actually struggling to continue to grow its funding. But I would also just say this is a very, very important point that the viewer has raised, this issue of, a kind of a double taxation. And we hope that this does not last forever. But this is the cost,
yes,
of historically handing over too much power to the state, conceding too much to the role of the state, and then waking up one morning and realizing that it's pushed you all the way to your taxation limits and you're getting virtually nothing for it.
Russell, can I add, this is the cost of handing too much power to the state, not handing too much power to the ANC government.
Yes.
It's handing too much power to the state. This goes back, well, in modern times, you can argue this is a 500-year-old problem in the world currently.
And we're starting to see this. It's maybe not as acute, but we're seeing this in a lot of Western countries right now, Gareth. People are taxed to the hilt. In most Western countries right now, you're paying 50, in some instances, 60% of your income away to the government. And perhaps for the last 100 years or so, that's seemed like you're getting some bang for your buck, you're getting some services. But those services increasingly in a lot of these countries are deteriorating as those welfare systems become unsustainable, as they're sort of starting to implode through just unaffordable fiscal obligations and so on. So this is actually starting to become a problem everywhere. And I would say that the kind of mechanisms and institutional resistance that we're developing in South Africa is to some extent quite unique. We're dare I say it, a little bit ahead of the curve on, I think, what a lot of people are going to have to try and get right overseas. So I know it's tough for people out there, and I know it's difficult to pay your taxes and fund not just organizations like Sakalicha, but your private schooling and your private security and all these things that you're having to pay for over and above your taxes. I totally get that. But this in many ways these are the unavoidable costs right now to get through this time of protecting order in an increasingly chaotic state where vacuums of order are emerging. We have no other choice other than to kind of bear this cost and grit through it. And so, as you say, Gareth, we're a resilient people. We're a resourceful people. We're still standing, and we continue to fight.
Well, I mean, let's not forget, since Pete brings up history for the last 500 years, let's not forget that the United States, which is the most powerful country in the world right now, they have the biggest economy of all the United States, came to be because the Brits tried to levy a tiny, I think it was a 2% tax on tea. And in the Boston Harbor, they decided, fuck that. And they started throwing the tea off of the ships. And that was the beginning of the American Revolution. So it doesn't take a lot of people to make change. It really doesn't. Anybody who's had enough could be the one who sets the whole thing on fire. And by no means am I encouraging crazy and violent revolution, but I am saying that this is yours. You've worked for it. No one else has a right to it but you. Let's just quickly, before you guys go, and I know we're running out of time here, so as briefly as possible, and either of you can grab these. A lot of talk in the last year about the Bella Act, a lot of talk about the NHI. Now we've got the Expropriation Act on the table. Government really are in a hurry to get so much of this done. The partners that it has in this national government of national unity, the GNU, seem to be helping them more than helping the people who elected them. What do you guys think is going on here? Why do you think all of this is being pushed through as quickly as possible? Why do you think these laws, which are very destructive, are being pushed so hard by the ANC? What do you think the behind-the-scenes motivation for all of this is?
Gareth, there's a few moving parts there, but let's just zone in on something like the NHI. We've got a government that's desperate for control over more and more resources. This is a kind of fairly common modus operandi of a socialistic ideological orientation. They want to control more. They want to grow the state wants to grow its domain, and its domain is the domain of getting control over private resources. So I think that's a huge part of what's driving the NHI. Gareth, the NHI would be just about the worst healthcare system imaginable. Nowhere on earth, perhaps barring North Korea and a couple of other strange places, has as extreme a healthcare system, state-controlled healthcare system, as this NHI system proposes. Now, I don't want to scare people. This is a very tenuous proposal by the government. It's something that's very opposable. It's in any case, even if it were to come into play, it's going to take a very long time. So this is not something where people have to panic that they're going to wake up tomorrow and their healthcare is going to be gone. And we're mounting a very strong challenge against it, as are many other organizations. But people need to understand that this absolutely has to be fought. Doctors are dreading the NHI. Many doctors will leave this country if the NHI comes in. Many people will leave because they won't be able to get decent healthcare, and that'll be a final straw for many productive people in this country. So the NHI is a huge problem. It's very disappointing to see that the president sign the NHI, knowing that he was going to go into an election probably where his party would lose the majority, and maybe that's why he did it. But that doesn't seem to have slowed him down post the election. The president has assented to several harmful pieces of legislation since the election. These are extremely destructive. And I think, people will have lots of theories and conspiracies about where all this stuff comes from. But at the end of the day, Gareth, we have a government that's hungry for resources. It's insatiable for resources. It tries to dream up all sorts of weird and wonderful justifications for why it gets to take your next, chunk of resources away from you, and why it gets to control this or that. And we simply need to say no, and we need to start pushing back. What's been proposed in the NHI is completely absurd, and it should not form the basis of any kind of negotiation or compromise. It's simply an absurd proposal. It's totally extreme, and we need to bring this all the way back to a sensible kind of discussion. And last point on this is the healthcare system without the NHI is overregulated. It's regulated in all sorts of ways that would take a whole show to explain. We need to unleash the creativity of the medical and healthcare sector. We need to produce more doctors, nurses. We need to get the private sector cranking up. We need to enable and actually make lawful, which is currently essentially unlawful, to provide low-cost medical aid and medical insurance products to the low end of the market to get people into the healthcare system and get them getting healthcare. There's so many great things that can be done through the markets on healthcare. And we're getting bogged down in this ridiculous NHI debate. We should not be there. That's not where the negotiation terrain should be. Peter, I don't know if you want to add anything around any of that stuff.
Unfortunately, these acts come from people who believe in them. And the actions speak louder than words, Gareth. So I don't think we're going to see an end to this. The ANC seems to be firmly in control, consider itself firmly in control, and is generating more and more. So we're in an accelerating phase, not in a decelerating phase, and that's a problem, and that means we must be up for the challenge to just become stronger, quicker than the government can make itself be harmful.
The theory that the ANC under the government of national unity would move into a more compromising posture seems to be at this point invalidated.
Yeah. All right. Well, listen, you guys are doing God's work, and you're doing a lot of work for the rest of this country, whether they appreciate it or not. I would encourage them to appreciate it with their wallets and see how they can get involved. Make sure you find out more by going to Saakalicha's website that you said is saakalicha.org.za, right?
Correct. That's right. Yeah. Saakeliga. Good Afrikaans name. Saakalicha.
Yeah. /en for the English, but there's also you can do a language switch up left on the website.
Very good. So it doesn't matter what language you speak, you will understand what language they're speaking when it comes to all these covered today. And really, I'm sorry, guys, that we've only scratched the surface, but I appreciate so much your time and how busy you guys are. Make sure you go and check out their website. Make sure you find out more about what Saakalicha do, and in so doing, inform yourself a little bit better about the kind of predations that this government is visiting upon you, your business, your money, your family, and all the things that you care about in order to extract whatever they can, like a bunch of vultures. And Russell Lamberti and Pete Theroux, keep doing the good work that you're doing. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. That's a wrap on us. You got a bonus couple of minutes, so I'm happy to have had these guys in the studio for a bit longer. Big thank you to Ben. Big thank you to Simpiwe. And we will catch you on Monday at 6 a.m. bright and early. Thank you very much. Cheers.
When people saw, they put saliva with the paper and then they share that soul. It means they are also sharing. If when people saw, they put saliva with the paper and then they share that soul. It means they are also sharing. If when people saw,